Tiff Davey here, today's host on the Behind the Collective podcast. We wanted to take this opportunity to thank the Australian Beef Breeders Association for their ongoing support of the Livestock Collective. As a not-for-profit, we rely on support from organisations like them to do what we do. Today's episode is a good one. We set up a makeshift podcast studio next to a gooseneck in the Northern Territory, and we chat with Jess DiPasquale about how Catherine Woman rode in the Mongolian Derby, a 1,000-kilometre horse endurance race across Mongolia, her love for Brahmins, and, of course, all things Northern Territory ag industry.
So my name is Jess DiPasquale. I am from Catherine. I am born and bred. I have just started my own Brahmin stud. I spent 9 years running the Brahmin stud at CDU, at the Royal College, and then when I finished up there and decided to go out on our own, so my husband and I also have a helicopter business, so that was the idea, to go out and work within that business and do something for our own selves and spend a bit more time with my kids. And then whilst I was doing that, I decided that I missed the cows and I needed to go back to that, so wanted to start my own stud. So I bought 3 heifers from some people in Queensland and have gone from there.
And so have you always lived in Catherine?
More or less, other than when I was very, very young, my grandfather used to manage a station, Mabel Downs in the Kimberleys, and then when that all got handed back, we all moved back to the Territory, and then I was very heavily involved with horses as growing up, and then it's sort of only been since I finished school. Or not, I used to go mustering and do all that sort of stuff. My uncle's got a station down at Lakefield, and used to do a little bit of stuff with him, but was predominantly horses until I finished school, and then I went and worked on stations in the Territory and the Kimberleys, and then come back to town and ended up at the Royal College, yep.
And did you know when you were in school that you wanted to work within the industry when you finished?
Yes and no. I actually wanted to be a sports scientist, but that didn't work out. At one stage I wanted to be a vet, but that definitely didn't work out. But towards the end, I was definitely like, yes, I'll just go and work on a station for a bit and see how that works out. And then it just continued on.
Yeah, so how many years were you working on stations around the place before you went to CDU?
Probably not all that long, really. Maybe like 5 or 6 years. And then I come back to town because I was sick of chasing cows. So I thought... And I worked at the council for 6 months in town in an office job, and then I got offered the job at the college, and I was like, yeah, I've had enough of the office job, might go back doing something with cattle and horses, so yeah.
And I've asked this question a lot today because the Territory is really unique in the sense, like, obviously cattle are a huge part, or beef is a big part of the NT, but also people. You've got big stations, big crews, it's quite transient, a lot of young people. Now, in your time at CDU, you would have seen a lot of students come through, but as well as on stations. What would you describe? What makes a good leader?
Somebody that's able to lead from, like, the front, not just sitting back, barking orders and saying this is how you should do it, but somebody that's in amongst it, doing it as well, and, like, leading their crew, not just, yeah.
Have you worked amongst some good leaders? Like, did you have mentors when you were coming through? Or even bad ones that, you know, you took away traits that you were like, okay, I know how I want to be.
Yeah, certainly had good and bad, for sure, yeah. Definitely. I think there was a lot of people that were very old school and, like, you know what you're doing, you go and do it. And then there was some that would sort of nurture you a little bit more, or back then probably wasn't the right word, but give you a bit more training and stuff. Like, somebody that, a leader to me is somebody that can teach you to do what you don't know what to do and lead you through that. So,
and what would you what advice would you give your younger self if you were just starting out? I know we get a lot of young people listening to the podcast who want to head north and have those years. What would you tell yourself if you were?
Probably slow down a lot. I was always very in amongst everything and probably fairly adventurous, but slow down a little bit and just learn as much as what you can from the people that are above you, because they've been there and done it before, and the more you can learn from people, the better.
Now, back to the Brahman stud. So we're here recording this at the Catherine Show. You've been washing cattle all day. You've had, I can see a few ribbons there. So this was judging happening. Tell me about the stud. So how long have you been doing it? Are you at the point where you're selling bulls, and where are your clients? Tell me all the ins and outs of a stud.
Very fresh. So I bought my first three heifers in 2003, and I got two of them AI'd in Queensland, and they carved out in July last year. So the two that I'm showing tomorrow are the first lot. I do have another bull calf at home. He's a bit younger, but decided not to bring him. Like I said, very fresh, so I'm starting from the ground up. I do have some commercial cows as well, which I have appendixed their calves because they are by a stud bull as well. So I will work them through the system. And I did buy another cow this year. She's had a few calves, but just working it in. Like, I will just continue to buy a couple a year, whatever we can work in. Basically, it's a hobby at the moment. Our main business is the helicopter stuff, so that is the focus. But yes, definitely working towards the bulls. I want to sell bulls. Something else I would dearly like to do is to be able to consult to people, go in and help them go through their herd and work out what their objective is, and then look at their herd and say, right, we need to look at this area to fix up, and then this area, or, you know, whatever, and then go into looking at bulls that suit, not just throwing money at bulls that aren't actually doing anything, just picking out the areas that they need to work on.
And even in the NT, so it's very vast. You've got Downs Country, you've got Rough and Ready Country. The NT is a really, really big place. If you were to be giving advice to people in the NT, is the objective, should they be different for the cattle in the NT based on where you are?
Certainly. Say Catherine North, even a little bit, say Mataranka, even Larimer Way. North is like your export, and going back the other way, yes, you've got a bit more opportunity of sending them south. But at the end of the day, everyone's going to have a different objective and how they see an animal and how they want their animals to look. And it's like, I mean, it's not just about how they look, it's about their temperament and everything else that goes with it, and how you work them that makes a herd and makes an animal be able to produce a calf every year.
Long-term, absolute long-term goal. You've said you're going to continue to grow the herd. You want to, you know, advise. What about winning the Catherine Show with a bull? Is that on the list of...
Oh, man. We're not playing for sheep stations or anything here, but it's... it would be nice, for sure.
Yeah, have the winning bull. Are the prizes good?
Oh, you know, you might get a bit, $50 or something. It's oh, all right.
Like, have I, like, half a bag of feed?
I get a carton of beer or something.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, the next thing I want to ask you about, and I'm sure you get questions about this a lot, the Mongolian Derby.
Yeah.
So in my research, I discovered that, yeah, you rode over there. You've said you've always been a horse person. So, you know, was that something you always aspired to do, or where did you get the idea to do that?
Well, I lost my way a little bit with horses. I'm not going to just say it was the kids. It wasn't. It was prior to that too. A few influences that just, there was a lot involved at time, and I just threw away the horses a little bit. Yeah. Still, obviously, I still had them, for sure, but I didn't ride them, and I used to ride them for work and all that sort of stuff, and that was fine. But then I had kids, and used to always say that I wasn't a very maternal person, and that I didn't really take to motherhood. I think that's a lie. That was just something that I told myself in the end. But I decided that I needed to do something for me and me only, and so I jumped headfirst into this race with another friend who is actually here at the show at the moment as well, Natalie Bell, and we decided we were going to ride together, and so we did all the training and did everything together and did as much as we could, and we did fundraising, we did heaps of cool stuff. We fundraised money for not only the Mongolian charity but also a charity that was very close to our heart, which was a very good friend of ours that died from sarcoma. And so we raised some money for that as well. And when we got over there and everything got together and we got going, and we ended up being separated at the first horse station. So it was a bit hectic, but and not really what we planned. But yes, like the Mongolian Derby sort of turned up because I seen a couple of people that I knew do it, and then as I went on and each year I watched it, the bug got me a little bit, and yeah, Natalie and I decided we were going to do it.
I'm fascinated by it. So what is, like, I suppose for those who don't know, what is the Mongolian Derby?
They call it the longest and toughest race in the world. So it's...
She's eye-rolling, those who can't see this because you're listening. She's just eye-rolled.
So, it's a 1,000-kilometre horse race across the Mongolian steppe on semi-wild horses.
And is it inspired by, like, the nomads in Mongolia? Why do they do it?
Yeah, so it's from Genghis Khan days, so the Ma run that he used to do with the war. And just the toughness of the horses have been able to gallop for kilometres on end and cover a lot of country, basically.
Yeah, and how do you train for that?
You can't. And basically,
was it like equally being able to physically ride a horse for a long period of time, but like a mental thing as well?
Yeah, it's more mental than anything.
Yeah.
So like bums in saddle, yes, you need a bit of fitness, and I know a lot of people. I was nowhere near as fit as what I probably should have been, but it was bums in saddle and the mental stuff that got me through.
Yeah. But mentally, how did you prepare for it?
Yeah, I decided it was just another day at work.
Yeah.
So I got up in the morning, packed my stuff up, loaded my saddlebag. And saddled my horse. Well, actually, they saddled our horses. And then if I decided that horse needed a little bit more, I could ask the Mongolian herders to jump on that horse.
Mm.
Easy. I wasn't there. I wasn't proving anything. I just wanted to finish the race. So I'd get one of the herders on. And then if I didn't need it, I didn't need it. Mm. I'd just get on and go.
And are the herders incredible riders?
They are amazing. It's unreal. Like, there is a completely different style to how we ride, completely different. And they can stay on anything, basically. If they get thrown, it's probably a pretty nasty horse.
So if they got, that was like your thing, if they've fallen off, I'm not getting on it. Like, that was like the baseline. Why are they so good? Did they just like put them on horses at 2 years old, or why are they so incredible at riding?
Well, they don't technically break their horses in like we do here in the Western world. Like, they pretty well rope them, scruff them, saddle them up and get on them and gallop them into the sunset. Like,
they steer them? Like, I've weirdly ridden more camels than what I have horses. So if they have not broken them in, how do they tell them where to go?
Well, I think a lot of them sort of learn over time to just neck rein. Like, that's sort of the one thing that if anyone is listening and is wanting to do the Mongolian Derby, watch what they ride, how they ride, and ride like a Mongolian. Because the minute you go back to riding like we do, them horses like,
like, what is whatever this person doing?
They just do not listen. So just ride like a Mongolian, and they are rough and ready.
Yeah,
but and stand up in their saddle, and like you just.
And how, because you change horses, don't you, throughout the race?
Yeah, every 25 to around 40 Ks, depended on the leg, but yes,
Yeah, and so you just didn't know what horse you were getting. You get given a horse, so this is yours. Is that how that kind of works?
We were sort of picking them, and then towards the end, they were giving us like a lotto system where we were picking numbers out of the hat. And you could swap a horse out within the first few kilometres if you thought that I never did, but... if you thought it wasn't going to be right. But most of them, like, I rode, what did I work out? It's like 30-odd horses or something over the 10 days, and I had two rubbish horses.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And what was the hardest part of it all?
Honestly, the hardest part was the first horse station, leaving Natalie behind.
Yeah. And how what happened there? Why did you have to...
So Natalie got a two-hour time penalty.
Yeah.
Her horse didn't come because obviously, like, they need to be welfare aware.
Mm.
And so the horses have to come back in under 56 beats per minute within half an hour of getting to the horse stations. And her horse didn't come back under. We have a feeling that it was used the day before, and there's probably a few other factors involved in that because, like, she didn't ride any harder than what I did in that leg. And, yeah, the horse just didn't come down, and then so she had to sit at the first horse station for 2 hours.
The horse stations, I've seen photos. It sounds chaos. So try and paint a picture. You've got Mongolians everywhere, wild, like, not wild horses, but, you know, I presume there's people everywhere. Like, paint the picture of what that looks like, a horse station.
So they have their gurs, which are, like, their nomadic... like I want to say a tent, but it's not a tent. There's a hell of a lot more to it. You know, they have gers and they have a whole lot of water buckets or water troughs to try and cool the horses down and give them a drink. And there's just people everywhere. And if you're at the front of the race, it's probably very quiet. And if you're in the middle of the race, it's completely hectic because there's a lot of other riders there with you and a lot of people going everywhere and horses going everywhere. And if you're at the back of the race, it's probably pretty quiet too. So, yeah, it's definitely chaotic.
And if you were to pack again, what's one thing like you wouldn't leave behind? Panadol?
to be honest, I did take a lot of anti-inflammatories. I went into the race with a few injuries and I come out of the race with a few more injuries. Yeah. But to be honest, like the medics cover all that sort of stuff. You really don't even need to take that stuff unless you're camping out for the night. But to be honest, I did take a lot of stuff that I didn't need. Probably a spare pair of shorts for the night. Like that, like
it's a good piece of advice, I reckon.
Yeah, like, I mean, I didn't do that. I had like long undies on, like running shorts sort of thing as undies. And so I could take my leggings off, tights off, but it was still like they were my jocks, you know. Probably would have took a pair of shorts.
Yeah, no, that's good. So you went in to this feeling a little bit lost. Did it help you find you again or your purpose?
To a degree, yes. It made me decide to look at where I was in life, and I quit my job.
Yeah.
and then spent more time with my family. So I think that was a big thing. I did get a little lost after that, but that, you know, that just, I didn't expect that. Stopping full-time work and going into looking after kids
full-time. And was there a come down too from something? Because it would have been like, how long do you prepare a year in advance? Or how long do you have to sign up early, you know?
Well, we were supposed to ride in 2021, but we signed up during COVID. Yeah. And then because of COVID, it got extended out and we didn't ride until 2022. So we had quite a bit of preparation. Usually it's around that 12 months.
So there would have been a come down from that though too.
For sure.
Yeah, like you've got a purpose, this goal you're working towards, and then it's done.
Yeah, there was definitely... There was a lot going on after I come back.
Yeah.
For sure.
No, yeah. That's so fair. And so this is a big question, but what's your why now?
Look, I'm really passionate about breeding animals that can not only suit the environment, but they look nice and they are fertile and they can, like, they're the all-round cow. I feel like there's a lot of selective stuff go on where you've either got it really fertile and it looks like a dog, and then, or you've got this really good-looking animal and it's not fertile at all. I can't see why we can't just have a happy medium, and especially for up here and in the Brahman breed and stuff like that. So
What's your thoughts as someone who's obviously very passionate about the Northern Territory ag industry? Are you confident in your future and its future up here?
Absolutely. There is a lot of people that are pushing and working towards making it a hell of a lot better. And I don't see why we can't be any better than anywhere, like any less than anywhere else. Like we should be the pinnacle. There is so many people that are keen to do better, and the cattle up here are awesome.
What's the key to a strong ag industry here in the NT?
Education. There's certainly, like, there's a lot of people that are still very old school and stuck in their ways, and just learning to do things differently and that it can be better. And
what's your favourite thing? And just so you know, I asked this to Brad and I said summarise and he couldn't. What's your favourite thing about Brahmins?
Their attitude. They are so funny. Like, this is literally this afternoon. I took my two out into the ring to have a look around because they have not left my place. They've literally been in a yard together the whole time. They're very not exposed to any... Well, they have been exposed to a lot, but... Anyway, we brought them in and they've been very clingy. Took them out there and they were so funny. Like, Brad brought his bull out and my bull was like, "Hey, who are you?" Walked over there and sniffed him, and just they are so funny. They are so animated. They're just an awesome animal to be around.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think good answer. Because people are scared of them. People are scared of the Brahmins. They just, I don't know, there's this stigma. I think the poor things have got this stigma associated them with this wild, you know, north cattle.
Yeah.
And it's not always that.
They're not at all. They're proper sweethearts.
And final question, favourite thing about the NT?
It is an amazing place. There is so many awesome things to go and have a look at. And if you can, if you know somebody that you can get off the, you know, the usual tourist track and go and have a look out and about, it is just mind-blowing. We've had a lot of family and friends come up, and because we have the opportunity, we've got helicopters as well, so that kind of helps.
There's perks.
So, we can go and show them a bit different, but even just like, you know, our property, we got 500 acres, just 20 k's out of Catherine, and we got a fire pit, and we sit around, and, you know, it's just an amazing spot. Like, even now, watching the sun go down, it's just so cool.
Thank you, Jess, for your time. After this episode was recorded, Jess took her cattle up to the Royal Darwin Show and she won Champion Supreme Exhibit Bos Indicus. Thank you for listening today. The Livestock Collective is a non-for-profit aimed at providing information and capacity building within the supply chain. Our education projects include our website, social media, and attending events across the country. Our capacity building projects include leadership workshops and things like this podcast. If you know someone you want to hear from, send them our way. And if you value what the Livestock Collective does, subscribe to us to continue to support the work we do in sharing your story. And if you value advocacy, then please invest in us.